Record. All right, I can expand this out and see most of the people here that are in the class. So welcome. This is class period number 4 in our special segment where we're studying about studying. And we're also going to study a book of the Bible, really in 2 more lessons. We'll look at, start with an overview of 1 Corinthians and then dive into the text by about lesson 9. But where we are tonight is just to think about what it is like to just have a Bible, to pick one, and then how to use it, and the variations that we can experience in choosing a Bible and also the tools that would be available. So that's lesson 4. I think we might just start before we dive into picking out the Bible and talk briefly about the right setting. I'm not sure this is different from studying anything. If you wanted to really, really study a book of history or learn mathematics, I don't think you'd get that, or even maybe read a novel carefully. I don't think you'd be able to do that if you just kind of put a couple of minutes in and then put it down, or tried to do it while you're watching TV, or trying to carry on a conversation with someone else, or with lots of stuff going on like food on the stove or other activities, going on all around, people coming and going. And so I think it's probably important for us to think about where do we study, where do we read, if you want to call it just reading. But I think it needs to be a place that's private, that's comfortable, that doesn't have a lot of technology. I won't get into whether music helps you concentrate or it doesn't, distracting. But it seems to me that there could be no more conducive environment than a very quiet place. It may be that you'll want to read aloud or have the tools of audio Bible read aloud to you while you're looking at the actual text yourself. That gives you 2 channels, one coming in through the ears and one through your eyes. Those are ways to read. But I suspect there are times when you don't want that because the voice will pace you and get you, make you keep going when you want to stop and ask yourself questions or go back and look at something that's passed by. So reading aloud yourself allows you to do that. I think if we're open to God's word and think of it as God's word, we should be struck probably quite often, more than I am. I probably should be more sensitive to that, to ask myself, what do I learn from this? Am I reading about this character and that really looks a lot like me sometimes? Or this is a challenging statement of Jesus that I'm not living up to in any way. Or this is a danger that I might face one day. I need to be prepared for that. So there are all kinds of things that we could do in reaction to that word, in addition to just trying to understand it. I think there's a routine, regular rhythm of study that helps. As with any skill, the more we do it, the better we are at it, and the better we are at it, the more we like it. You probably have that experience. Something you're just terrible at that makes you uncomfortable is not something you're eager to do over and over. And that's my problem with the game of golf, by the way. A few times I've tried it, it's been a miserable experience. But I'm confident that if I set my mind to learn about golf and learn some of the skills and did it enough that I had all the tools ready, and it was not inconvenient to do it, and I actually occasionally had a success, that I'd probably grow to like it as I got better at it. That's true with any skill, but certainly Bible study. And then I think of workspace and tools, and I mentioned that briefly at the beginning, but it may be that you want to have a special place that has very few distractions, and maybe it grows into be the place where you study, and it when you get there, you're more in the mood to do it. Sometimes my desk gets more and more cluttered, and sometimes I just have to stop and get everything off of this so I can lay out what I want to see and get all the things that I don't need to be looking at that'll distract me from study, get them out of sight. So those are not about choosing the Bible. It's more about choosing our habits and our spaces to do that study. Does anybody want to share lessons that you have learned or practices that you've adopted that help you read and study better.
Close the door behind me.
Yeah, I've talked too long already. Didn't get anybody to do that.
Hey, Marty, I would just say sometimes it just helps to have something to be accountable to help with some of the studying, to like have a group of people that you're studying when you're meeting together, to have some kind of goal to keep you accountable. Sometimes that helps.
Yeah, pushing us in that, right. I guess the analogy to golf would work if I had a golfing buddy or somebody that challenged me more and encouraged me at it and that kind of thing. That would be a big help for sure. Yeah, thanks for that. I think that's part of the whole idea of you know, an annual Bible reading program is you feel a sense of accomplishment if you're keeping up and if you're sharing that reading with others. Yeah, so that's good. And that's part of what I meant by routine, but anyway. All right. Let's talk about choosing. Oh, thanks for that, Adam. I appreciate you breaking the silence there. Yeah, we're all we're learning to be Zoom zombies, I'm afraid. And but anyway, I'm going to talk about several topics about choosing a specific Bible. And I think the title's bad. I think we should say choosing Bibles, plural. And I mean that in various ways. Different translations, different formats, different Bibles with different tools, Bibles with different pagination that have room in the margin or don't have room in the margin. Electronic versions, digital Bibles are mentioned on here, audio Bibles. So we're so fortunate to have it and have the Bible available to us really essentially for free in about every variation you can imagine, visual and audible, with all kinds of tools and notes and all that. It's a kind of a, it's ironic that in this time where it's more available than ever in all of history, we covered in the first lesson the growing illiteracy of our nation and maybe even our own families of what the Bible actually says. And probably because there's just an equivalent explosion in every other kind of media and entertainment that would distract us from study. But anyway, I want to talk about translations and then some other features of Bibles that you probably are aware of, but we could just talk briefly about them. And so here is a list of things we'll talk about. I'll come back at the end and we'll see what we've covered in each of these. And I hope you'll participate. Share with me what you like about your Bibles, things that have been helpful in certain settings, and we'll share those lessons. And that's kind of the point of the lesson tonight. What I'd like to do is have somebody read, and maybe, let's see, somebody who didn't speak up before. We'll have Clayton. I think I heard your voice. How about read Genesis 1, 1 through 3, and I'll put it up on the screen. Are you ready? All right.
Yeah, I don't know how well you can hear me, but this is, I actually tried to jump in there when Adam commented. I was going to make mention of another, and maybe it was in the tools category that you had a couple slides ago, but you know, having colored pencils and other writing utensils with you and kind of working through your reading in that way, I think, is a good tool for me. But it also brought me to another question I was going to ask you related. Can you go back just one slide?
That one or this one?
Well, workspace and tools, that was where I was thinking.
Right.
But in the next slide, when you talked about different translations and different types of Bibles and different, you know, marginal notes or different editions that you use, I have a Bible that I've had since I was like 15 that's got all of my notes, you know, scribbles, and I don't know, I feel like I'm kind of handicapped if I'm not using that Bible.
Right.
I feel like I know a lot less. You know, I can't find things if I'm borrowing somebody's Bible. Or, of course, that was a problem when I started, you know, going to my phone and reading things electronically. I'm like, you know, I can't find anything anymore. So I don't know. Maybe you'll cover that. Is that a problem that I've handicapped myself by using this Bible? It's become a crutch for me. Maybe it's well, like I say, it's handicapped me, and I feel like I don't have as much ability to speak on topics. If I don't have that particular Bible with me, you know, that's sort of thing to me is a problem. So I don't know that I'm looking for an answer right now, but you can maybe address my problem.
Yeah, I will say some things related to that. I would just probably at the moment say that I think just like you'd have different size, I can't think of it, screwdrivers for different type of jobs. I think there'd be different kinds of Bibles you might use for different types of studies. One of the most frightening times of my life is I lost my Job Bible. And I remember getting angry with Mary because I was sure she had hidden it somewhere or at least misplaced it or whatever. And it's an NIV version. I decided to study, learn about Job in detail from that version because it was more readable. And so much of Job is difficult to translate anyway, so the literal translation is not all that important, it seemed to me. But I got all my Job notes in it. And finally, I got a big Sharpie and put Job Bible on the spine of it so that whenever I teach Job, I go find that thing. And so, you know, I think there probably there's an old friend kind of a feeling about a Bible you've had forever. You know where things are on the page and all that. May even have special favorite notes. But I do think there are different tools for different settings and studies, yeah.
It was important enough to me that I wore it out and had it rebound so yeah. that I wouldn't have to redo all those notes and everything. I felt like I would be starting yeah. from scratch.
I got pagination. So I have, you know, I have the same Bible, just old ones and new ones, you know, that this same pagination, the version of the American Standard. We'll talk some more about that. But that's a good question. And I think it's just like anything, there are different tools for different purposes. And always a place, though, for an old friend like that. All right. Thanks for that comment. Other comments on that?
And I wanted to say this. I'm kind of like him. I'm used to the King James Version, the old King James Version. And when I hear other people reading out the other version, it don't sound nothing like what I've always learned. So it looks like to me I'm learning the Bible all over again.
Yeah. And that's a good thing in a way. Because I think we can get kind of settled into the version and the wording that we're used to and maybe miss new thoughts that come out from translations that are newer, that are more up-to-date in the English language and even more up-to-date, and I'll try to explain what I mean by this, more up-to-date in the actual Hebrew and Greek in the sense that there are more sources now to be more sure of the original Greek and Hebrew texts that we're translating. So not a bad thing. And my problem has been when I was a kid, I memorized all kind of things, all out of the King James. And then I went to college and they made us memorize out of the American Standard. And then Embry Hills has had the new King James Pew Bibles forever since the 80s. And so I tried to memorize out of that and preach out of that. And till the point is, and now everybody seems to want to read out of the New American Standard or ESV, despite the Pew Bibles. So I'm the same way. I have it half memorized, but it's the new King Standard version, you know, that doesn't match anything really. But anyway, let's talk about choosing a Bible. And I'll mention, so that if you really went to the original text, which we don't really have the autographs, that is the literal paper or papyrus or whatever that the, or tablets of stone, I suppose, in some cases, that the original Bible was written on. We don't have those in a museum somewhere, but there are thousands of copies, all of which combine to give us a pretty good picture, and I would say it grows every year to be more accurate, of what the original text looked like in the Hebrew or in the Greek. And I think maybe Chaldean, isn't that the other language that Daniel, part of Daniel's written in or something? I can't remember. But anyway, that's what it would look like if we could see it. And of course, that's not of use to us. And really, it may not even be of use to Hebrew or Greek people if it's really a kind of an archaic version of the language. Go ahead.
You need to read that. I was going to read it for you. But.
Oh, okay. Sorry. All right. Yeah. I mean, don't forget to read from right to left, of course, too, because it's not a very good print here, but there are little pronunciation marks and things to help you know exactly how to pronounce it and all that.
Yeah, if it wasn't so fuzzy, I probably could.
Yeah, right. Yeah, same with me. So we're going to talk about mostly translations, and I want to compare some verses and kind of give you a sense of why it might be important to look at multiple translations and really see the differences between the approach that people took, the scholars took in building some of these translations. Now, you understand that it really wasn't until the 1500s that somebody actually took it upon themselves, Tyndall, I think it was, to go from the Greek New Testament text, which somebody had compiled, directly to English, right? Before that, it went to Latin, and then some of the Latin was translated. And, of course, in those days, under the Roman church, it was dangerous. In fact, Tyndall lost his life to do that kind of translation in the common languages. Luther translated directly into German and Tyndall into English for the first time. And then another fellow did the actual Old Testament. They put the two together. And it wasn't really till about 1530-something that there was a combined Old and New Testament translation from the original languages into English. And, of course, English in the 1500s is not quite the English that we have today. So that's another complication as well. And I'll talk briefly about the format that is found in some printed Bibles, additional references that you will find often in an off-the-shelf Bible, how the text is organized, not so much about that, and then maybe some additional study tools and information as we have time. I might just show you on the screen some of the electronic tools that I use. They're free, but they're very helpful and very easy to use. So here's a brief history of the timeline of English Bible translations. And as I mentioned, you go back to the 1520s, and this was at a time when in England the Roman church still had power, and Tyndall did the first translation from Greek into the New Testament and printed it. Another guy did the Old Testament, and by 1535, combining the two, there was a complete Bible in the English language. Actually, Tyndall did a revision during that time as well. 1537, Tyndall's Matthew Bible, second complete Bible. I'm skipping over lots of other historical events, but these are kind of interesting milestones. 1560, it was the first printed version to add numbered verses. So that's interesting that it was is that a millennia and a half until there were actually verse numbers? And we think of them as, essential part of the Bible to have the verses, but there weren't such things until 1560. And then the Bishop's Bible, I could say more about it, 1568, was important because it really was the foundation for the King James Bible. And so when the Church of England came to power in England, and after some politics and all of that, it kind of became obvious that they better come up with a version of the Bible that people that could be approved. So King James authorized the printing in 1611 of what's now called the King James Bible. It seemed like, I think I remember a story that one of the apostles is actually Joseph or something, but because it was King James, we ended up calling him James, as in Peter, Andrew, James, and John. That's an alternate version of the name, but it may be related to the King of England. He got the name James in that translation and has had it since. In 1885, an important event occurred, and that is that there's really almost a starting from scratch from the original text, which had grown in number by then. And something called the Revised Version. If you read old commentaries, you'll see references to the RV. That's not a recreational vehicle. That's a Revised Version. And it was a major undertaking. It had both American and English translators, British translators. And they couldn't agree on everything because even as early as then, the American English was different from British English. And so the American translators agreed to wait for 15 years, I think it was, before they would publish their translation. And the Revised Version in England had the American translators' suggestions as footnotes. And then the 1901 American Standard Version had the British translations as footnotes. So they swapped although they're essentially the same. So if you've seen an old commentary, a reference to the RV, that's pretty close to being what the American Standard has, with the footnotes just swapped in those two versions. But that translation probably set aside some of the poetic forms of the King James that Florine likes, and that is the kind of the wonderful language, you know, of the that was from 400 years ago. By the way, if you actually saw the 1611 version, you wouldn't really hardly be able to read it because of the words that were chosen, the printing, and so on. But that translation, which is now, you know, coming up on 120 years old, was a major effort to be as literal as possible, often sacrificing readability. And by now, of course, 120 years later, it's a lot of, even though the Americans are closer, it's archaic and it's difficult to read, even for Americans, because our language has evolved so much in 120 years. I stuck this milestone in. It's not related to English translations, but in 1947, y'all see where I am. I should probably be marking this up. In 1947, an important event occurred, and that is the guy over there in Israel, legend has it, I guess, he threw a rock into a cave and he heard some breaking pottery, and that was the beginning of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which dated back to really nearly the time of Christ and earlier, actually, actual documents. And so for the Old Testament in particular, a lot more information about the original Hebrew was available. And if I'm not mistaken, they're not even finished yet pulling out all that they can from those Dead Sea Scrolls. I think they've made some copies. They've put them on computers now, and people can still look at them. It's not all Bible, but it's other things, but it helps us understand the language and all that. But that's important. So I think any version before 1947 would not have had the advantage of that additional textual information. And so that you'll find in some, for example, New King James will have footnotes that indicate that later versions, blah, blah, blah. And that a lot of that has to do with manuscripts such as the Dead Sea Scrolls being discovered and available and improving, greatly improving our awareness of what the original text would have been. I just have to put an editorial comment in here. At a time when faith in the Bible and its accuracy is dropping, I believe God has providentially provided more and more evidence that we kind of had it right and that it really has not varied a whole lot over time, and has increased the accuracy of our ability, increased the accuracy of our original text, knowledge of the original text. In 1971, the New American Standard was an attempt to take the old American Standard, update it for modern English words, but maybe maintain the accuracy of the American Standard. 73, the NIV, phrase for phrase translation is very important. What that means is it's not word for word. You understand that word for word is more like the American Standard, New American Standard. Phrase for phrase means, yeah, maybe a coupling of words. They'll try to match that with an English phrase, but we're not so set on making every single word match, or that there is a word in the original that will translate into a word in the English. And, of course, that leads to paraphrase, which is, would be even at the other extreme, and that is just read the sentence and then kind of rewrite the sentence in a way that's easiest to understand, never mind the choice of words or even phrases. And then the New King James was in an update, a modern version from the old King James. And then in 2002, the ESV, which was trying to, you know, fill the gap between the readability of the NIV, which was phrase for phrase, and the American Standard, or New American Standard, which was more accurate, and try to put something in the middle, which was readable but also accurate. Okay? Questions or comments on that? That's kind of interesting history, but you begin to see now that each translation has its own story, right? Has its own group of translators. It has its own history. It has its own original documents that are available. So when someone says, what's the best? Well, best for what? Readability? Accuracy? Use of the most available texts, translation by the most conservative scholars who believe in inspiration, translation by people who don't have a religious agenda. And I'll show you some examples of that in some of these verses. So here's a kind of a spectrum. I got this offline, and I actually had to add the ASV in there because it wasn't on the list, and that hurt me, so I had to put it in there. And I just made up where I think it belongs, so you can disagree with that if you like. I think it's probably right beside the NASV. Remember, it has more archaic language. It's difficult to understand. But you see the spectrum there goes from word for word, even if it's awkward in English, thought for thought, which is a little bit more, you know, loose, but maybe is readable, to paraphrase, which really is almost all readability without a whole lot of accountability to the words, the actual Greek choice of words in English that match the choice of the words in Greek. So that website down there is where you can go. There's a lot of charts like that on that website I thought were kind of interesting. Okay, let's give this an example. I want everybody to think about, so I'm picking versions from the far right, word for word, or far left, I guess you're really looking at, and all the way to the far right, which is readability is paramount. Paraphrase is all it really is. So let's read this, and I'd like some comments about good and bad for both. This is from 1 Corinthians, and I've tried to pick examples tonight from 1 Corinthians. Reading over here on the left side, so I'm starting right here. In the American Standard, love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not its own, is not provoked, taketh not account of evil, rejoiceth not in unrighteousness, but rejoiceth with the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. That's the American Standard. Can anybody tell me why that word "and" there is italicized?
Not in the original.
It isn't. And what's interesting to me is that's the only word in this whole list that the American Standard translators felt was not in the original. Now, one problem I'll just mention, I don't know if we're going to come up with this, but you realize in a paraphrase, it would be useless to try to italicize some words and not others, right? There may be some words that do correspond to the Greek, but you'd never finish really since you're going to really be changing some of the words, inserting some other thoughts to make it readable. So it seems to me that's helpful to see an italics indicating that it's not in the original. But that also implies that somebody cared about whether there was a word in the Greek in the original that was there or not. I think that's kind of an important thought. All right, let's read the Good News translation over here on the right. And I'd like some comments about what you like or don't like about either of these. Love is patient.
On that previous little meter, you had the Good News translation was way over the right?
Yeah.
Good.
And that's, you know, this is the Living Bible and, you know, stuff like that, New Living Translation and all that. Okay, so let's read one of those. Love is patient and kind. It is not jealous or conceited or proud. Love is not ill-mannered or selfish or irritable. Love does not keep a record of wrongs. Love is not happy with evil, but is happy with the truth. Love never gives up, and its faith, hope, and patience never fail. So give me some reactions, those two texts, if you're reading each of those.
Well, Marty, at least on the first one, the American Standard Version, when we got down to verse 6, It became easier to process for me.
Why is that, Teresa?
The words were more familiar. And if I was trying to read 4 through 5, I would have had to maybe just – then I would have had to be trying to process, okay, vaunteth, not. Yeah. And then I would have to try to process what that means, or I may even just go ahead and look it up and try to see what they mean by it.
Okay, that's great. That's a great illustration. Y'all hear what she's saying is these are words we don't use every day, right? And maybe they were used every day 120 years ago. And you notice, too, the strange verbs in there, vaunteth. We don't say that anymore. And I'm not sure they actually said it in the 1800s, but still, I think if you're reading the Bible, you're expected to speak that way. I still remember and still hear occasionally people praying with those kinds of verbs, but it's just archaic, and we don't really talk that way anymore. And as Teresa pointed out, there are words that we don't use, and maybe there are words that even we do use, but they mean something different. I'm going to show you an example of that in just a minute. So that's one disadvantage of that. This is interesting. Another interesting point. This American Standard has a footnote, and it's one of those English-British-American differences, I think. If you look up that footnote, it says covers all things. So apparently the British translators felt that covering all things was a better translation than bearing all things. Now, I don't know which it is, but I'm happy to know that it could be either one of the two. That helps me understand a little bit more maybe what this text means. You see that? I would get more information, not less, from those choices like that.
While you're on that one there, bearing or covering, it seems that must correspond with something you see on the right side in verse 7, but I have a hard time, you know, figuring out, which word is it that we're translating something different, because neither bearing nor covering is in the right side.
Right. In fact, this last sentence just kind of combines it all. It's faith, hope, and patience. And I'm not sure any of those words are actually in the original at all, but maybe that's the thought. And so now if I was reading this to somebody who never read the Bible, that had no idea how to read these kind of, you know, seeketh and vaunteth words over here, do you think they could get some help? They could kind of get the point from reading this text over here in maybe an everyday sense? I think they probably could. And I think actually what Clayton actually did is kind of an interesting point, and that is when I see it and I say, wait, is that really in the Greek or not? Are those good thoughts to have? I mean, and if it isn't, maybe I ask myself, well, why did they translate it that way? Is that a thought that's valid from the original text? So it may raise questions that are good to raise. May not answer them, but still it may actually create thoughts that we don't have before. But you kind of get the point.
And Marty, I would say that very last sentence on the Good News translation, patience never fail, that is not seen in the American Standard Version. It never says anything about it never fails. It talks about its strength, but you know, it may be a subtle difference that may actually be accurate, but to your point, if you don't know if that's what was in there, then it's taking an idea and stretching it a little bit, and you could be on shaky ground.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think anytime you paraphrase, you're going to be two steps removed really from the original, one through translation, the other through, softening or clarifying or expanding or whatever the English version. I want to go back and mention one other translation that we didn't talk about. This is an interesting translation here, and it's shown, you know, way over on the kind of closer to word for word side. Is anybody familiar with the Amplified Bible? Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
Or do you know what it's about? It seems to me, what was it, old Brother Gear that, you know, used to read to us years ago? The old folks would remember him. He loved to read out of the Amplified Bible. And it seemed like in that case, the translators, they just they didn't try to pick a word. They just picked them all and put them all in there. So a lot of times a text would have three or four words in English for one Greek word. And they were all possible, you know, or expansions or maybe elements of what the connotation was of that word in Greek. And so that I thought that was an interesting reading. You probably never preach out of it or even memorize out of it or anything, but it's not bad to read from in that it gives you a superset of the meaning instead of, something different or simpler, you know. So.
Hey, Marty, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Hi. So on that previous chart, would you say that you agreed with where those translations were on the left side?
I'd probably rather not answer that. Anybody else want to answer that? Yeah, everybody knows I have a bias against the ESV, and it keeps growing. Every time I find something, I'll show you an example of why that might be true, but there's lots of other points I can make, but I'd rather not answer generally. Do you agree with it? Is that why you're asking?
I was just curious. In my opinion, I thought that the American Standard had, you know, some of the best scholarship. And I followed that up with the New American. That's as far as I got.
So you agree with this and this, right? These right here.
Agreed.
Yeah. And the Amplified Bible is just an interesting spot because it doesn't take a position a lot of times. But if you really wanted word for word, you get lots of words for each word. So that's kind of interesting. For a while, I did use the RSV. This was back 30, 40 years ago. It always seemed kind of more liberal to me. Might have scooted it over closer toward the NIV or something like that. But I know the NIV is very popular, and we'll look at that. I think they just have a good marketing campaign, and I think they've done some other things that make it popular in the culture. The other thing I would say is that none of these are really quite static. Even the New King James, if you get one that was written 20, 30 years ago, it's likely different from what they're publishing today. They're still making minor changes. That's true of the New American Standard version as well. I don't know that it's always improvements. One thing I've noticed about several of the versions, ESV and ASV and the NIV for sure, is they've gone about neutering the language. In other words, whenever it says a man, or, you know, they'll change it to if anyone, or sometimes they'll even add brothers and sisters, even when the Greek only says brothers. And it's pretty clear that they mean all Christians, but I think those are social forces that are maybe pushing them toward less sex-specific pronouns and terms, especially for man instead of people. They'll put people in instead of all men or something like that. And those are all just political forces. And probably, remember, people don't publish these Bibles for free. Are y'all aware of that? That they make money at it. And the more they sell, the more money they make. And so in many cases, it's a little bit dangerous when there's an incentive to have a version that's, you know, specially tailored for feminists or something like that. There's a different motive besides scholarship.
Marty, you said something that has it sparked a conversation memory. You said political forces. And of course, there is the economic motivation to produce another version of it.
Yeah.
And that timeline that you showed several slides back that had all of the different versions, you know, back to 1611 and even, yeah, I guess you got to go way back.
I can't find it. There it is.
There it is. So, now, you made a statement right around this time here in tonight's class that you saw an element of providence in bringing out more evidence that what we have is reliable and what we have is good. And it's difficult for me to be able to explain to someone when new information comes out, providence, and when is it economic or politically motivated. And I mean, how do we know that any one of these versions or translations in this timeline were motivated or are you know, funded by Providence versus the king who just decided he wanted an apostle named James? You know what I mean?
How
do we know the difference?
Well, I don't know that we do, and I think that puts more burden on us. I actually think that as time has gone by in the last century and political forces and a kind of a, you know, a devaluing of the Bible in any form, original texts or translations, we probably have to be more careful. But again, perhaps providence, we have a lot more tools. I'll show you some before we're finished, I hope, things like the interlinear that you can call up for free and just look at. And you can decide for yourself whether they've skipped over some key elements of the Greek version. So I think at the same time we could question the motives of the translators. We could also, even without a whole lot of scholarship in the Greek and Hebrew languages, we can check. And you can see some of those tools have become available too and popularized. So, yeah, I don't know if I've answered that question or not. We can't be sure, but I think we'll have a growing set of ways to test it and learn ourselves.
I think, Marty, part of what you may have been referring to, things like the Dead Sea Scroll discovery helps us to realize that the copies of the copies of the copies of the copies of the text that was written 2,000 years ago is still valid, right? Because when they found something that old, they could date it back to the time of Christ and say, hey, after 2,000 years of copies and only making copies of copies of copies, we still have it extremely accurately from what the oldest extant copy there is there. So I think that's sort of what...
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I don't know that I said that, but that's probably the most important point to make about the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's not that we learned so much more, is that we learned that what we had was really quite accurate. And it kind of put to bed the myth that somehow the Catholic Church had, you know, had control of all the texts all through the Middle Ages and changed them all, so we don't know for sure what the Bible ever actually said. And that just kind of blew that out of the water. It was that story was over, and it just didn't make any sense. Yes, I think that's right. And with credit to the Jewish scribes who worked so hard to keep it right. I think I'm going to skip over this one. I'm going to show you some more examples from 1 Corinthians that are and talk briefly about the difficulty. But here's a verse in 1 Corinthians 7. On the left is the New King James Version, which, as you might remember, was kind of, you know, toward the left. And then the English Standard Version, which I would put a little bit less accurate. But here's what noted. We don't have to read it. You can see I'll put it in red. Notice the difference. Why would the word slave be used in New King James, but in a newer post-2000 translation, the word bondservant would be put in there? Anybody have any idea?
They mean different things.
Well, it might mean different things, but, I mean, it's the same Greek word. If the word is doulos, which means to bind, it's literally, figuratively, involuntary or voluntary slave, etc.
Maybe they didn't want to be offensive, and the word slave may be more offensive.
Would it be more offensive now, do you think, that it might have been back in 1980 or something?
Maybe.
Maybe. So what I want to do is, if I can make this work, I would like to show a movie. If I hope it comes through, I think it will. And this is from a BBC special on the translation of the ESV.
We're ready to get started this afternoon. And the question before us today is the translation of the word slave in the Bible.
There's three main Hebrew words to be considered. Eved is the most general, broad term that's typically rendered servant.
Give me a thumbs up if everybody can hear that.
Then for women who are in servitude, typically shikha and ama are your standard terms, and they don't all have to be handled the same way.
All right, thank you. Now, I think others who wish to...
Just a few things. I'm thinking of the principal male word, eved. It occurs a lot in the Bible. It's about 800 times. Mm-hmm. And the majority of those, we currently have a servant. But if you were to make the word slave consistent and start using it for the verb, then you'd end up being slaves before God, you'd be slaving for him and so on. So I feel the most consistent way is to put servant everywhere.
If you look at the dictionaries, it's quite clear that the difference between a servant and a slave is whether they are owned by the master or whether they're paid by their employer. And it's quite clear in many passages in the Old Testament where it talks about Eved, that the person is owned is regarded as part of the property of that person. I think we are getting confused and reluctant to use the word slave because we think that because there is the word slave, that the Old Testament approves of slavery. And I think it's very much better to say that the Old Testament is trying to improve the life of slaves rather than pretending they're not slaves.
Okay? Anyone want any sort of clarification from the report? Okay, then I would ask Jack, you wanted to follow up with something quickly?
I don't think I disagree with anything that Gordon has said, and I'm not sure I disagree with very much that Peter has said. And that's the challenge that we're facing, and that as an American, the term slave is a term that is difficult to think of as a humanized institution at all. Although, surprisingly enough, some of my African-American correspondents are less sensitive about that than I am.
So, Wayne, you want to ask or make a comment about the Old Testament side of things?
When we as scholars
use the word slave, we have in mind something of a study of the background of slavery as it existed at the time of the Old Testament, slavery at the time of the New Testament, and we can understand nuances of it. But for the average English reader, the word slave has irredeemably negative associations and connotations. In people's minds, it's a permanent condition, whereas in the Old Testament, and certainly in the time of the New Testament, it's temporary, it leads to freedom. And it was often voluntary, at least in the first century. Number two, slavery in the Old Testament or the New Testament was not primarily racial, it was economic. And third, was often a situation that had status and carried considerable legal protections. And for those reasons, I think we are importing highly inaccurate understandings of the meaning of the term.
I think it's time for us to vote without, okay, we're not needing summaries. In the text of 1 Corinthians 7, the change is at four instances, from slave to bondservant. Those who are in favor, please raise your hands. We have nine. Those opposed, we have three. Thank you. So do we want to take our break now? There's no problem.
I think that would be a good idea. I think it would be an appropriate thing to just give thanks to the Lord for the way he has led us through this path.
Dear Father, what a delight it is to be your children, members of your household under your care.
Okay. You see, you kind of see the difficulty. You can see several things that make translations complex. I was going to get your feedback, but you probably heard some of the very comments that we were making, right, about the baggage that the terms carry, the evolution of the concept of a particular word like slavery, our ignorance of it, actually, or the ignorance of everyday people who are not scholars about the New Testament days. And so I've just listed a few things that I think make translations difficult. One is, how much do we really know about the knowledge of the original language? For example, Hebrew apparently has far fewer words than English does, at least the versions that we have of that ancient Hebrew. And so many words have more than one meaning, and you kind of have to know what the setting is because they're reusing a lot of the same words to mean different things. We have some of that in English, but apparently it was more of that in Hebrew. You probably are aware that Greek has more complex verb tenses, six of them. We have roughly three without some extra words stuck in, and lots of five different noun cases, which indicate their place in the sentence and the meaning and the grammar. And there are not any English equivalents for those. And then, of course, there are some words we just don't know what they mean, especially, for example, plants and animals. We don't know exactly what animals they were at that time, and probably other words as well. There is a growing certainty, but sometimes a slight variation in the original text that we're using to translate from. That has created some adjustment over the years. Not much, as David pointed out, as you might expect. And then, of course, the main thing really for translation into English, and I'm sure every other language, is that changes in the English language has changed a lot, including connotations associated with words, just like we just saw, like slavery, for example. So, Clayton, here's the marketing thing. I think the target reading level of the purchaser is kind of important. I think that some of these other translations are really almost in many cases aimed at people who don't read much at all, and maybe they need a very simple language, or maybe they have a unique vocabulary or dialect that needs to be accommodated somehow. And then cultural forces, like the neutering of the language and so on. And maybe marketability. So you can get a Bible for feminists or a Bible for any kind of political view, that kind of thing. So those are intended to, of course, make it more marketable. So those are some of the translation complexities. Did y'all like that video? I thought it was kind of revealing of all the things you have to go through. But it illustrates that. Go ahead, Wayne.
It was interesting that it was settled on a vote.
It says something, yeah. Yeah, I've had the same thought, but how else would you do it? These men are not inspired, right? I guess you might, if you could measure the sizes of their heads and pick the smartest guy, that might help, but I don't know if that would work. Here's an interesting dilemma, and you can kind of see one of the things that annoys me a little bit about the ESV, but there's really only one word for woman and wife, and there's one word for man and husband. There's not really a word for husband or wife in Greek. And here's a text from, again, 1 Corinthians, the first part of chapter 11, where it's describing the headship of God of Christ, Christ to man, man to woman. And on the left, you see the American Standard. And you notice there's really just these two words down here, honor and gune. That's man and that's woman. It's also husband and wife, and you just have to read the context to know. Well, the American Standard just said, okay, it's woman and man, and you'll see throughout that's the only two words that are used. But notice in the ESV, it's man here and husband here. It's the same Greek word. But in reading that, you'd never know that really it was the same Greek word, but they've just decided to make a choice of man in one part of the verse and husband in the second part of that very same verse. And you see the same thing here. So wife down here, it's a disgrace for the wife to cut her hair. Why does it say wife there? Why not woman? Is not true for all women? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But their decision was to take the same word, gune, and make it wife here and then woman right here, just a few verses later. Do y'all see the point there? I wonder if there was a reason for that. In the translator's mind, perhaps I'm making this up to limit the application of this covering passage only to be a custom for married women in the presence of their husbands or something like that. I'm just telling you, when you translate it this way, you certainly leave that kind of impression. That sounds like it's critical. I guess it is, but I'm just saying, note that it seems like if you're going to translate a word one way in the context, you ought to stick with that just so I will know as a reader that the Greek word is exactly the same. Here's another one that's kind of interesting. 1 Corinthians 6, again, verse 9, has a list of sins of people that will not inherit the kingdom of God. And he says, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with men. Those are two different things. So you see there's one kind of sin and another kind of sin. And if you look at the words there, the first one is something that's soft or fine or effeminate. That means probably a man looking like a woman is the idea, acting like a woman, playing the female role in a sexual relationship. And abusers of themselves with men would be someone who's a sodomite, that is more playing the male role. And it comes with these two phrases here, arson, which is man or mankind, and coite, which you can, you know, is related to coitus, as you probably know. So it's having sex with men. But those are two different things. The ESV, for example, just says, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, period. Just one thing in the list. Although there is a footnote that kind of indicates there's two different Greek words, which is helpful. You'll notice the New American Standard even simplifies it more, nor homosexuals. And, of course, the NIV makes it just simple language, men who have sex with men. None of these three would you get the idea that really there were two different sins being listed there. Just an interesting example. I wonder why they would simplify it that way. Here's another example. In the book of 1 Corinthians, we're going to learn about spiritual gifts. And the ASV, the Greek here only has the word charisma for gift. It doesn't have anything related to spirit or spiritual. And yet the NIV puts in the word spiritual, just puts it in there. It's not in the Greek at all. And again, here, now concerning spiritual gifts, now the American Standard puts in gifts, but notes that it's inserted. It's not really in the Greek text. Same thing here. But, of course, in the NIV, it's gifts of the Spirit, which emphasizes even more this gifts, which is not, there's no Greek word for gift there. And again, down here in chapter 14, verse 12, since you're zealous of spiritual, actually, with a footnote that said the British people thought it might be spirits. Might be just because that's really more the word. It's pneuma, not pneumatisko, which is spiritual. It's pneuma. You're zealous of spirits, maybe is really the literal translation. But again, the NIV, more like a paraphrase, sticks it in as gifts of the Spirit. There's no word for gift at all there in the Greek. And the same thing, if any man thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, and that's the pneumatisko, spiritual word in Greek. But again, the NIV puts gifted by the Spirit. There's no word for gift at all. Why do you think the NIV would keep emphasizing gifts of the Spirit when those Greek words are not even in there? And there's no wrong answer. I don't know the answer either. Wayne, you have an idea?
I was going to say maybe there's a bias in the translators.
Might be. And maybe it's a translation that would read well for those who believed in, you know, gifts of the Spirit everywhere. And especially, you know, at the beginning of the book when he's not even into the discussion of spiritual gifts, but they put it in there. That's just an example. All right. I'm sorry to have taken so long. I hope it's been somewhat interesting. I want to tell you about cross references and footnotes. This is out of the American Standard that I've used forever. And what you see is in the text, there are these little notes beside the words. You can kind of see them in here. There's G. And you just go over here, and that G right there will tell you to go look at verse 20. And you'll find out more information or related things. I have always been impressed with the relevance of these cross references. In addition, there are footnotes. And so, for example, here's a quote. You can tell by the indention here, there's a quote here. And from Isaiah, and so that footnote 10, you look down here, and it will tell you where that Old Testament text is. Sometimes it's hard to know exactly. Sometimes it's a combination, but often it will have all of those. I believe the New American Standard imported most of these notes, if not all of them. Mason thinks they got them all over. So that's another place you can get that same help there. But you can see how many there are, so many that it spills over into the bottom. Notice that texts often will indent or put in all caps or in some way format quotations. Here's something that's maybe good and bad, and that is that this is out of a New King James. And notice now that there are paragraphs, but there are also headings of the paragraphs that kind of tell you what the section is going to be about. Now, the difficulty with that is I sometimes would like to figure that out for myself and not be biased when I go into that section to decide that's really what it's about. But you understand that these section headings are not inspired. They're not in the original Greek text, just like the verse numberings and paragraph divisions are not either. But that's sometimes helpful. You can see that. And you'll notice here again, formatting of a quotation mark. And then also in the New King James, there are the interpolated words are put in italics, right, that are not actually in the Greek. Which I always feel better because it means somebody cared about whether that was in the original Greek or not. I often hold my Bible up to my ear and say, this is a self-pronouncing Bible, right? And it's not really quite true, but if you go back and look in the text, all the words, even words like Jesus, will have accent marks and lines over the vowels and dots and things that will tell you exactly how somebody thinks you should pronounce those words. So you'll find that in the beginning of the Bible somewhere is this guide. That's always helpful because some words are difficult to pronounce. One of these Bibles has a little brief concordance in the back. It's an English concordance, not Greek, but it helps you find words that are in that particular translation. You might actually even have a dictionary and some other information in a Bible. And a lot of times a book will begin, they'll have a paragraph that says who wrote it and when it was written and kind of what it's generally about. Please understand those are not inspired words. That's somebody else's version, and it often contains doctrines that we would not agree with. Calvinism, maybe things related to spiritual gifts, eschatology, how the end of time will be, are often included in those because they're published by some religious group. Or written by a religious scholar that doesn't see the Bible the same way we do. All right, I think I've covered all of these things in one way or another. I thought it might be helpful just to show you some tools that I use. If I've got them up here. Here's the Bible Gateway. And it's a free app, which means that I'm the product. And you can see on the left what I search for on occasion.
Because, we can see what you've been Googling over there.
Exactly, well, right.
I can vouch for it.
Yeah. I actually have smart wool socks on at this very moment, as a matter of fact. But you can see here, this you can change the translations from the New King James to whatever version you like there. Holman Christian Standard come up. If you want to compare, you can put side-by-side translations and keep putting more translations all up at one time. You see I'm adding in. And so if I wanted to I could put anything beside the others there. I could show that. The little icon here says it will actually read it to me if I want it to. Again, this is BibleGateway.com. I find it very useful. You can cut and paste if you're trying to, you know, make notes and on another sheet. You can actually put the text right in there, or you can put a link to a passage. You can search for words if you want to. If you're not sure where, you might find the word gifts in there. Here's all the references to the word gifts and how many times they occur in each book of the Bible. So 1 Corinthians has 10 references, and here they are. That's in the Holman Christian Standard. That's just the one I picked. So there are a lot of useful tools there. Again, you will be, you will be sold stuff in the margins and so on, but normally it's decent stuff advertising on a Bible site like that. I'll show you one other tool that's a free download. It's a native app. It's called eSword. I use this quite a bit. And it, you remember on the far left-hand side, did I get it right, of the meter, Clayton called it a meter, was something called an interlinear. And if you really want to look at the actual Greek and the comparison to English, and usually these are done with the old King James, but here actually is every single Greek word that goes with that. So the word church there comes from, guess what, the word ekklesia, and you can read about it down here. It's a combination of these two words here, calling out. And so grace is charisma, which is, by the way, the same word as gift that you saw under spiritual gifts. So it talks about the grace of God, and it says you're not lacking any gifts. I think those words are meant to be kind of connected. They're charis, the roots, both of them, although in English you'd never know grace and gift had anything to do with each other. And the same thing with holy and sanctified. Those words are really the same in Greek. Things like that. So you can begin to notice that in the text. So you pick any book you want to, 2 Corinthians, and go to chapter 6, and there are all the verses, and you click on the words there and do that. So these are tools, I think, electronic tools. Bible Gateway and eSword are just two that I use quite a bit. You may have your own favorite. On my phone, Bible Hub is a good one that has lots of different versions. And then there's also, I can't remember what it is, that has the interlinear as well. I've forgotten. Anyway, Bible Hub has the interlinear. All right, I'm done. That's enough for tonight. And I'm sorry to have gone so long, but I appreciate your participation. I hope it's been useful. I think the answer to all the difficulties is have as many Bibles and as many Bible versions as possible and grow in the use of the tools that allow us to look behind the translations, maybe even to some of the original language behind it. I think that's the answer. Comments? Help?
Well, Marty, just real quick on the ESV. When I was reading the ESV, I don't read it anymore because sometimes some of the verses are not there. Like I was reading and let's say it has 22 verses, but then they may only use 20 verses or 21 verses and a verse is just missing. So I kind of just gave up on the ESV.
Well, I wouldn't do that. I think it's useful. I don't think they take verses out willy-nilly. There may be some places like at the end of Mark where some of the early manuscripts don't have that last little section in it, and they may just put it in a footnote. But I don't think they surely would just leave out whole verses without some reason or without a footnote to explain it. I'd be surprised or disappointed at that.
Okay. But,
don't give up on any of them. They're all useful.
I'm wondering if you're going to share an affiliate link where we can go buy an ASV and get a cut.
I'm not sure that they even sell them anymore. I don't. You might be able to find them on eBay. That's all I could say. I don't know.
I think it's the public domain. I'm not sure if it's.
So that's the thing. I mean, Nelson Bible published the original ones, and the plates got so worn out. This is the Nelson Bible version, and you can see that the text is nice and black and, you know, and all that. Well, the plates pretty much got worn out, but they sold them to Star Bible, and then they had this grayer version because the plates were wearing out. But they got the rights to publish it for a while. Mason's kind of an expert on where to find it. I don't really know. I've got enough to last me the rest of my life, probably. So, not to mention that I can use Bible Gateway. So.
Yeah, it's all there electronically. That's a benefit of living when we live.
Yeah.
You said something talking about the NIV and gifts of the Spirit, and I don't know, maybe some people translated it a particular way because they wanted to support a particular view on gifts of the Spirit or what have you. And it put me in mind of a conversation that I had many, many times with different Jehovah's Witnesses who have an idea about the nature of Jesus. And as you know, they have a very particular translation of the Bible that supports their view. And I tell this kind of story here just because it supports what you're saying. Have many translations, because I can look at pretty much any translation here on your meter and they will support the deity of Jesus. But if I look at that one translation that my Jehovah's Witness friend wanted to use, he was able to choose verses out of it that would support or that would refute Jesus's deity. So I say that, again, just in support of the comment that you made, Marty, that having so many of these different translations and being able to show a consistent doctrine, I suppose, from so many different translations. If you have one translation that you cherry pick to prove a point, and that point cannot be proven by the multitude of translations, then maybe that point is not a correct point.
That's really good. That's right. And especially one that stands out as different from all the rest, and especially when it's published by a group that has a specific, unique doctrine that it supports. Yeah. Yeah, that's all. And even more reason, I think, too, to get a little bit familiar with how to go behind the translations to the original, using an interlinear or other tools. Yeah, that's good. Catholics have a Bible too. Same thing. Interesting things in that. I noticed none of those are on this list.
You wouldn't have had no problem if you just go back to the King James and be through with it.
Yeah, well, we'd be reading the Apocrypha maybe, but.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't mention that, but the original King James, you know, had the, well, actually, right before that, up until then, there were 80 books, right, including the Apocrypha, the books from between the Testaments, Maccabees and those, and that's in the Catholic Bible as well.
You know,
Marty, do you, I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Marty, do you know what they did with the rest of the Bibles? I mean, it's... Now, that other slide you had said it was 80. They decided that the rest of them were invalid?
Well, they're really writings of history, but no one really had – oh, I shouldn't say no one. But for the most part, the scholars do not think of them at all as inspired. They come in that period of time between the Old Testament and the New when – there were not inspired men writing prophecies and so on. They're basically just books of Jewish history and some visions and things like that. But yeah,
that was 14 books.
The other thing I was going to say about all of the value of all these translations sometimes, and it's been a long time, I have to admit, since I did it, but just reading, sort of the story and for the pleasure of it, as you would maybe a novel. Sometimes these translations on the right-hand side of your meter, because they are in more common language and because they are easier to read and easier to understand, though you're not doing an in-depth study and you're not, you know, using it for, you know, a proof text or that sort of thing, sometimes I think there's value in even having these translations farther to the right on your scale here. I feel like we're kind of dismissing them a little bit because they might not be as accurate. And I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I guess I see some value if you're reading for the joy of reading. Maybe those versions have a little different value.
Yeah. I think I started by saying that I was in a panic when I lost my New International Version, because that's my Job Bible, right? The Book of Job. The other thing NIV does quite well is they work hard at preserving poetic structure. Of course, it's in the English language, which sometimes you have to depart a little bit from the original, but it definitely reads really well in terms of poetry. And I think that that's a place. So remember, we talked about different kinds of literature, right? There's narrative. That's a story, like you're talking about, right? It's just a story. And then there's poetry, and then there's discourse. And I think discourse is where you want the most accurate you can get. Books like Romans and 1 Corinthians and those, you really need to know as best you can what the terms are being used by the apostles and so on, or by Jesus, really. But the narratives, like, you know, the stories in the Old Testament, for example, I agree with you. And that's why I use the NIV for teaching Job and also Proverbs. I mean, in some ways, Proverbs is hard enough in Job, too, to translate. It's hard enough that the accuracy doesn't buy all that much because it's kind of fuzzy what the original animals and references and, you know, pictures. It's hard to tell exactly what they were. And they don't matter from the standpoint of doctrine. Yeah, good point.
I got you to the middle of the meter. Probably not going to get you over there under the red
zone. Yeah, I struggle with that. But yeah. There's like street Bibles that are written in, you know, urban language and stuff. But yeah, that doesn't interest me. But besides that, on Bible Gateway, that guy that reads the NIV is, what's his name? Very dramatic voice. I love to hear him read, right? Max McLean. Max McLean on Bible Gateway reads the NIV, and he's got a scary voice, you know, and it's kind of fun to listen to him. All right, that's enough. We've got speaking that's going too long. All right, that's enough. Thanks a lot. David will take over and make up for my my long classes by giving short class, right, David?
Yes, we have a 6 o'clock service follow, so I will have a hard cutoff. I will have to finish on time. So,
yeah, okay.
I hope to see you all again on Sunday.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Martin. That was very, very interesting. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.